Okay. Hi. I'm Pam Samuelson. I'm going to be your instructor for an information law and policy class this semester. This class is going to be great fun. And I say that in part because I know that at least for some of you, information law and policy just seems like, what could that ever have to do with me? This is kind of a weird part of the program that maybe I shouldn't have to die. Maybe I should get an exemption from this or something. And what I'm going to try to do over the course of the semester is persuade you that this is not only fun, but actually it's a big value added to your degree at Sims, right? Part of what Sims is really trying to be is a program that stretches your mind, stretches your skill set, gives you a wider array of things that you know about so that you can be the kind of person who isn't going to get outsourced to India, China, or the like. I think that the information law and policy part of our program, of which you get this dose, and if you want more, there are advanced classes. But even if you don't want to do any more, I think that you'll find over time that it'll give you a kind of grounding that actually will come in very handy. At least that's been my experience talking with some of our graduates in the past, is they didn't realize that it wasn't just a fun class. It was actually ultimately a very useful class, and I believe that's going to be true. So some part of what this class is going to be about that's going to add value for you is in professional skills development, right? The master's program here is a professional school, and your degree is a professional degree, and it's actually a really important thing for you to be sort of a professional as you leave here. And so what are the professional skills that you'll be learning in this class? One of them's writing, and I'm going to come back and talk a little bit about writing in the sort of toward the end of the day today. Writing is not just a good skill to have. It's like a desperately important skill. You don't actually realize yet necessarily how much benefit you will have in your career in the long run if you can actually write well. Alex Daly, who's back in the back row right now, and I are planning to work really closely with you, and so you'll have a set of four writing assignments. But writing is not just stringing some words together. Writing is fundamentally about, can I analyze something, right? Can I take some problem, can I take some situation, can I take some fact pattern, can I take some abstraction like network neutrality and make sense of it and have a coherent point of view and try to be able to communicate that point of view to other people. So the deepest part of what the value of the writing assignments is not just so that you get your grammar and spelling right, because the little program parts do that pretty well for you these days, but also that you end up with sort of sharper analytical skills that actually I think will be helpful to you in the long run. I would say the major goal that I have for this class is actually to give you a kind of a working understanding about some basic principles of information law, so that when you go out in the world, you can actually answer questions, you can also know when do you need to go talk to a lawyer, so that you can have sort of a kind of a flexible sense about the law. I think for a lot of people, law seems like, oh, it's that stuff that they put in books, you know, and the books are big and black and ugly, and you open it up and it's got this like weird formatting and stuff like that. And part of what I'm going to be trying to persuade you of in the class is that the law is actually a social construct, right? Now, in your first semester at the iSchool, you've already learned a lot of things are social constructs, right? And you may not have thought of the law as a social construct, but if anything is a social construct, it's law, right? We decide to have laws sometimes when we think that we need some guidance for people who are out there in the world and trying to do something. The law is supposed to do certain work for us. And so we pass laws sometimes, or we adopt legal rules sometimes, because they think they're going to do some work for us. And a lot of what we're going to be talking about is, you know, is this working or not? Right? Sort of what are the limits of the law? What is a way also that the law evolves to deal with new situations, particularly new technology? So advances in technology frequently present questions that the kind of existing legal structure doesn't exactly know how to deal with. So part of what I want to do is give you this sense that law is really a very dynamic thing. It evolves slowly. It's not exactly as slow as a glacier, but it's not like it changes all the time just like that. But it can change dramatically. And so part of what I'm going to try to do is kind of give you some sense about what are the things that actually endure over time, and what are the things that evolve, and how do you think about that. And also I want you to feel like the law is something that isn't just out there and pronounces what you're supposed to do or not do, but also that law is something that you have an investment in, that it matters to you personally, that it matters to the community in which you operate, it matters to the companies that you're going to be working for, it matters to all manner of kind of professional organizations that you might be involved in, and there's no reason why you can't have an effect on the law too. That is to say, if you think the law is messed up, then don't just sit there and complain about it. Let's sort of figure out a way to try to make it better. If we think it's supposed to do this kind of work for us and it's not doing that kind of work, then that's why we ought to change it. And so I think that this is, in some sense, an advanced civics class as well. Because it really is speaking to the ability of each of us to actually have an impact on our society through an engagement in the law. And I'll be trying to, as we go through our study of this subject, alert you to kind of where are the policy levers, right? What are the institutional mechanisms and what are the policy levers out there that allow us to actually have some impact? Sometimes, actually, what you want to do is get the state legislature to do something. Sometimes, in order to get something accomplished that's important, you got to go to Congress, or something else can be done by having communications with the Federal Trade Commission or some similar kind of agency. And so I'm going to try to alert you a little bit more than you are already to kind of what are those institutional forces out there and what roles do they play in the legal process. So you'll end up, if not from other classes that you take on information law and policy, at least from this class, with a kind of working sense about what law is really like. And so more on that later, but let me sort of move for a minute to kind of a higher level, more substantive overview. Part of what's interesting about the subjects that we're going to be talking about this semester is that in the past, these areas of law used to all be seen as pretty far away from one another, right? So there was a law of copyright. Oops, no juice. There was a law of copyright, and it was out there, actually for a very long time, until roughly the 1980s. U.S. copyright industries were, you know, non-trivial, but they weren't like a big deal, right? They were a small percentage of the gross domestic product. And in the last 25 years, they have actually tripled, quintupled in terms of sort of the size of the GDP. So copyright turns out to be really important, and in fact, you can't hardly do anything in the digital networked environment without running smack up against copyright all the time. But it used to be this kind of small little area over here. So it's gotten bigger, and it's gotten a little more complicated as the sort of the variety of sort of products and services have extended to all kinds of things. So that's kind of gotten bigger. There were little privacy laws over here. And so one was about video rental records. So some of you may remember that there was a time when Robert Bork, a judge and former law professor, was nominated to the US Supreme Court. And when Bork his nomination was pending before the Senate for confirmation or not, and not as it turned out. One of the things that that somebody tried to do to discredit him is look at the records of the video store that he rented his videos from and show that he's kind of looking at sexy stuff, which is, since he was supposed to be this like right-wing kind of like uptight person, the fact that he was looking at sort of dirty pictures was, so that was a way of trying to discredit him and trying to peel off some of the religious right sort of support for Bork. And so Congress decided, let's pass a law. Now you can understand that actually all members of Congress said, my Lord, I don't want my video rental records coming out the next time that I'm running for Congress. And so this one hit them at home. Right, and so all of a sudden, boom, we have a video rental record privacy law that's just special to that, right? Now, you rent anything else that's content, it doesn't apply. And so there are all these little special laws about privacy. We'll talk a lot about information privacy later in the semester, but there was kind of this cluster of little laws for little sectors and no comprehensive, really sort of privacy legislation. And then there was a telecom law. And it dealt with really boring stuff like pricing and yada, yada. And then there was broadcast regulation law, which was part of the same statute, but dealt with totally different kinds of questions. So again, I'm talking now, thinking about it from 20 years ago perspective. So 20 years ago, broadcast regulation was dealing with how many hours of television programming should any particular network have to provide that will serve children. And you know, if you're gonna allow this politician this much time to say his stuff about what he wants to do, then if there's another politician running against them, you have to give them equal time, right? So those are the kinds of questions that that law was dealing with at the time. And then there were other laws, like blackmail laws, right? Blackmail law. And then there was something, you know, over here, cryptography law. But of course, they had nothing to do with anything else, right? And so all these laws were basically just over in each individual sector. And sometimes there were, in context of broadcast regulation, things about rules about indecent speech. There was a famous lawsuit that went to the US Supreme Court, where a guy who was a religious person was going with his son on a road trip in New Jersey. And they turned on National Public Radio, and NPR was doing a segment of a skit by George Carlin about the seven dirty words, right? You can imagine which ones they are. I don't need to name them right now. But it was shocking to him and to his child, and all of a sudden these terrible words that children, of course, use all the time, all these terrible words were being broadcast and assaulting him and his son and undermining the training that he had given his son about not using words like this, and here they are on radio, how terrible this is. And so he made a complaint to the Federal Communications Commission saying this was indecent, speech, and so the U.S. Supreme Court had to ask itself whether or not the penalty that was awarded against that particular station, or the network that actually made that particular program available, whether a fine levied against them for this indecency was in fact consistent with the First Amendment. The U.S. Supreme Court decided in that particular case, in a decision which has had ramifications for internet speech, decided that actually, because it was focused on seven dirty words, and you didn't have to say those seven dirty words during hours when children were likely to be in the audience. So you could run the George Carlin speech or a skit sort of after 10 o'clock, because presumably all good children will be in bed by then. But the that was something that, you know, that was part of again, this one little segment, this one little sector of broadcast regulation. So a lot of what's interesting about what's happened in the last 20 years is that there's been a kind of a tectonic shift, right? So a lot of these laws that were previously really separate and distinct laws have kind of come together now, and they are now just components of information law. So 20 years ago, nobody. If you said, "Well, are you going to study information law in law school?" I would have looked at them like, "What are you talking about?" And so it wasn't a coherent question at the time, but it has become a coherent question today because one of the things that at least many aspects of these regulatory structures are dealing with is the flow of information, right? Sometimes the laws aim to make sure the information is flowing. Sometimes the laws are designed to restrict the flow of information. So this much, but not that much. So for example, in the indecency example that I just gave you, right? The Supreme Court didn't say that radio stations couldn't use the broadcast the George Carlin skit. They just said you can't do it during certain hours, right? So it was a time, place, and manner restriction on the flow of that information. And so it was a restriction here, but a flow there. And so it was a way to try to balance out competing interests of the interest, the First Amendment protected interest, the free speech interest in adults being able to have access to indecent speech, because as to adults, that is First Amendment protected stuff. But we do as a society have an interest in protecting children from certain kinds of depredations. And so the regulation that limited the flow of speech during certain hours was really a way of trying to accomplish both objectives, right? Protecting the interests of adults and protecting the interests of children. And so we sort of regulated the flow of information through that kind of device. And part of what's interesting about almost all the information laws we'll be studying is that they are all about when do you sort of restrict and when do you let flow and under what conditions. And ironically, there are times when restricting the flow of information actually means that more information flows. Okay, so an example of that is copyright law. Right? So why do we have a copyright law in the first place? We have a copyright law in the first place because we want to provide incentives to authors to create valuable works of knowledge, and then make them available to the rest of us, right? And sort of the theory of, that underlies the law, and query whether that theory is totally right. We'll have time to ask ourselves that question too. But the theory that underlies it is that if you don't provide some measure of exclusive rights to authors, and especially in a way that authors can then license distribution of their works to publishers or other commercial exploiters, that there'll be too little incentive for people to create valuable works. So what do? We give them a right to exclude. We get them a right to stop people from making copies and distributing copies and other things, right? We do that because we actually want the stuff to flow. We just want people to have to pay for it, okay? So this is a nice example of like restricting in order to allow flow. One of the other things that we'll see, again, this runs throughout our study, is that we sometimes distinguish between private and public. In fact, that's one of the major valences that we'll see in various laws that we study, is that to a large degree, things that happen in private spheres are less regulated than things that happen in public spheres. Right? So things that happen inside sort of the scope of your home or whatever private circle that you inhabit are less regulated than things that you do in public that can then end up having impacts on other people. And so things that you do that, you know, may not be, they may be in bad taste in the privacy of your own home or in a small circle of friends, become obnoxious if done in a more public setting. And sometimes they're not just obnoxious, they're illegal. And so again, part of what we'll try to do is kind of see ways in which that private-public distinction actually is a helpful or meaningful distinction that will help us decide when information should flow or not flow, and when regulation should cover things and not cover things. Another thing that's interesting about what's happened with information law in the last two decades is that things are starting to the categories are breaking down. So copyright, for example, now in some sense has a lot to do with privacy and has a lot to do with cryptography, even though those fields of law used to be totally, totally separate. Right? Now, what am I talking about? As you've, I'm sure now, there are many entertainment industry companies and other makers of copyrighted works that wrap their content, their copyrighted content, in technical protection measures, right? In some sort of encryption or other kinds of technical protection mechanisms, whether they're access controls or copy controls or whatever. And so, right? So one of the things that Congress did in 1998 is passed a law that made it illegal to bypass the technical protection measures that are used by copyright owners to protect their works and also to make tools that will enable the bypassing of those technical protection measures. And in so doing, copyright law kind of became an encryption control regime. You see what I'm saying? So a law about cryptography was export control law way, 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 way over here, had to do with munitions and other kinds of, you know, warlike defense products. Now, actually, encryption policy becomes more important, and what does privacy have to do with anything? Well, suppose that you are a subscriber to some sort of digital content service, and they monitor, right? When you download something or when you look at something, they can keep track of what you are watching, what you watch next, how long you watch it, and so forth, right? The technology is there. to enable people to do stuff like that. And yet, what we have is then copyright becoming a potentially privacy-invasive form of activity. And again, whether we want to regulate that activity or not is something that we may want to have a discussion about. So laws then are become part of it. It's not just there that we see that these things have in common, that they either regulate the flow out or in of information, but also that they're seeping into one another, right? So telecommunications policy is partly content regulation these days. It didn't used to be, and so as we go through the syllabus, I think you'll see lots of examples of all of that. And so that's the kind of, you know, the 60,000 foot level view about information law. And I thought actually that one of the ways to sort of illustrate to you that that information law has something to do with you, I'd just share with you a few things that I found in the newspapers in the last week or so. I'm happy to have your thoughts about these. So first one, and this kind of comes in the category of what if it happened to you or somebody you know, right? Okay, so here's the story. This is cyberspace lawsuit opens up a Pandora's box. It was published in the San Francisco Chronicle not too long ago. The article is about a guy who discovered that his girlfriend who had a blog, had related intimate details of their sexual dealings with one another on her blog. And he ended up getting fired from his job, in part because this became known to people who employed him. He also left to go into actually law teaching of all things. It's now embarrassing to him that this information has been made available on the web. And his students could see it. You know, it's like how can you have the kind of authority of being a professor if the intimate tales of your sexual life are sort of easily findable on the internet. So what he did is he brought a lawsuit. Such an American thing to do. He brought a lawsuit and he's suing for $20 million in damages. And what do you think about that? Yeah.
Is he suing his employer or his girlfriend?
The one who posted the stuff. The former lover. Presumably, they're not doing it anymore. He sort of realized that this was not the person to be investing in that respect. So, suing the girlfriend, the former girlfriend. Yeah.
I'd say it's probably two different things. First of all, you could question if it's legal to fire the guy based on private details, and then.
Okay, so the short answer to the first question is that there are some regulations that you can't be fired for certain kinds of reasons, right? You can't be fired because of your sexual orientation in many states, for example, and you can't be fired because you're of a certain race. You can't be fired because you're at a certain age, where age is like older. And so there are certain regulations about firing of employees. But for the most part, and this is kind of, put this in your little tidbit file, for the most part, employment in the United States is at will. which means that you serve as long as this is a mutually agreeable thing, and you can be fired at any time for almost any reason, unless you're in certain kinds of jobs, right? So I can't be fired, because I got tenure. But that doesn't mean that I can't be fired for a good reason, right? It means that I'd have to do something that was essentially a violation of some code of conduct that that the university could use. If I violated that code, then I could be fired for cause. And there are people who have contracts for a certain period of time, right? And if you have a contract for a certain period of time, that overrides the sort of the at-will nature of it. But for the most part, right, you can understand, suppose that this person was working for one of the more religious members of the house, right, to have the aides sexual life details, particularly since some of them were fairly sordid, on the internet, it doesn't, you know, doesn't make you, the congressperson, look good. So I think it's actually probably a pretty good grand for firing somebody. So that's sort of a legal question. But, of course, he wouldn't probably have gotten fired, or at least not fired when he got fired, but for the disclosures. And so the question that I'd like you to sort of just give me your intuitions about is whether or not, since he suffered some monetary damages by being fired, and he also suffered sort of emotionally, right? It's humiliating to have this kind of thing happen to you. So the question is it okay for this lawsuit to proceed? Should he win? You know, so profit might be a factor, right? To the extent that she was making money from humiliating him in that way, it might seem more offensive. Let's just posit for the sake of this discussion that she's not making money. Yeah?
I think he does deserve some kind of regrets because she has materially harmed him in that she could use it to have been the cause of him losing his job and also decreased his future earnings potential as well. So, in some ways, I could be seen as like stealing from him, you know, or burning down part of his house or something.
Okay. Igor. Yeah, but I'll bet she didn't talk as much about her activities
but
as his.
But this was information that was willingly shared, I assume. And, I mean, obviously, depending on the exact details, but also, I guess, so it would, first of all, she has some kind of a right to this information because it was willingly disclosed to her, and she was there. However, then there's the question of, I guess, reasonable expectation of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
But if the information was hers, then there's the right to free speech, which is she can talk about herself and her experiences all she wants.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, if we give this guy $20 million, does this mean that Monica Lewinsky can't have a blog? Or, you know, something like that? I don't think you want to discourage.
I think it was actually Linda Tripp that was the discloser of all that information.
Well,
Yeah, no. So one of the things that we have to consider when we try to address a question like this is what kind of precedent will it set if we allow recovery in this particular case? We're not just trying to decide in some sense, right? When you're a judge and you have to make a decision about something like this, you're not just thinking about this particular guy and whether this particular guy has been damaged in a way that the law should respond to, but you're basically making a precedent, right? You're making a decision that will have ramifications for other situations where information, perhaps not the details of sexual life, but other kinds of intimate details might be disclosed. And so part of what a judge or other decision maker has to think about is what are the implications of this for other situations that might be similar, and can I draw a line here that actually will be a line that is principled, but also then won't kind of lead to what lawyers call the slippery slope, right? That once you sort of say, well, any private information disclosed on the internet, unless it's about you yourself and you are disclosing it just about yourself, then you know we should have to shut down the internet, right? So you gotta watch out for what to do with that. I think you had an observation, no? Okay. Yes. And this guy actually was an aide for a congressperson.
Right, so there's probably some right to talk about this person in public. But then you would probably have to draw the line where it gets to intimate.
Okay.
And I would have said
so notice that one of the things that we're doing here is doing some private public boundary lines, right? We're saying this certain thing, sort of this information became available in a totally private sphere, and you're actually saying there's kind of a, you know, that private isn't just one vector, actually it's a couple of vectors, right? And there's kind of like really, really intimate things, right? Really, really private things, and things are like private but not that private. I think your sort of response is, gee, there's this kind of core thing here that's under attack, and the question is whether or not someone to whom, as was pointed out, there was in some sense a voluntary disclosure of certain information is provides a pledge, right, an implied pledge, not to disclose that information outside of this certain thing, and so. We're going to see as we study privacy law and as we study trade secrecy law, is there are certain circumstances in which the law does imply a confidence and will protect that confidence against disclosure. But there are other situations where, partly owing to free speech considerations, partly having to do with sort of other public interest issues. So some of you may remember that there was a revelation relatively recently, within the past several months, that some very conservative religious figure in Colorado had been having for 3 years intimate relations with a gay man, right? And so the gay man finally says, I'm sorry, right? This man has been having relations with me, and sort of he stands up in front of everybody at the church and on TV and stuff like that, and says, oh, gay people are evil and yada yada. It's like, this is what he's been doing for 3 years. And initially, of course, he denied it, and then eventually he said, oh God, I'm so evil. Okay, but do you see that that's a similar kind of situation, right? So you have somebody who was in an intimate relationship with somebody, there was then, right, a reason that they both had to keep that information quiet. But at some point, one of the two of them decides that that information is actually relevant to some, right, public knowledge, right, that public discourse about this person would be furthered, and the public would realize what a hypocrite he was and not follow his advice so much, maybe, because he was engaged in that kind of relationship himself, even though he was decrying it as like evil and yada yada, okay? So that's another situation where, right, if we're trying to sort of say, well, what kind of precedent would it set if we allowed this young man to get, he's not going to get $20 million, but if he was allowed to get some sort of monetary recovery from this young woman, and then there's actually a separate question about whether you could force her to take it down, right? If the information, in fact, is deemed to have been private and that it was a breach of the confidentiality to reveal that information, then why wouldn't you force Why wouldn't you force it to be taken down? Because that's something that people ought not to be able to do, right? Is to sort of get away with disclosing private information. Sometimes that's true and sometimes it's not true. Sometimes, especially if those private details get picked up by press and the like, right? Do we want to then say that the San Francisco Chronicle can't cover the story because the information's really private? You see that when we start kind of unpacking these things, it turns out that there's lots of really, really complicated things. I think there is no clear answer to the sort of the legal question, which I asked you to intuit about. But what I want to say to you is that this particular example of an information law problem illustrates a particular kind of lawmaking process. So part of what I'm going to be trying to do is help you kind of understand what kinds of laws get made what kinds of ways, right? Sometimes laws get made by statutes, sometimes it gets made through disputes. I'm this guy. I think my privacy has been violated. I hire a lawyer. The lawyer writes a complaint, delivers it to the court, files it, and the complaint then gets served on the young woman who was the blogger, then she has an obligation to show up in court. Right, as long as she lives in a jurisdiction that the court has power over her, jurisdiction over her, then she's got to show up in court. She's got to make an argument about it, and she's probably going to have to lawyer too. And the question is, then the judge looks at this thing and says, "I don't want to deal with this. Go away. You can't do that, though, if you're a judge, right?" So one of the things that then you have to say is, well, okay, let me look at prior lawsuits involving disclosure of private information when somebody sued and they either won or they didn't win. And let me compare what's going on in this particular fact pattern to the fact patterns of cases that have been cited before. So this is known in kind of the American system as the common law process, right? So there are certain kinds of laws that actually aren't statutes, but that when so-and-so sues so-and-so and slaps a complaint on a judge's desk, judge's got to decide, is this something that is a viable claim or not? And just because it's never been adjudicated before doesn't necessarily mean the case is going to get totally thrown out, although sometimes it does. But the judge is going to have to sort of look at the precedents that are out there and see, is this more like this set of cases or is this more like that set of cases? And then make some judgment, and that's one of the ways that the law evolves, right, to deal with new situations. So there hasn't been, so far as I know, a privacy case just exactly like this before. But there have been other cases involving disclosures of private information that caused people to get fired and so forth. And so there may be some cases that the judge will say, well, this is a lot like this one where a privacy violation was found. Based on precedent X, Y, and Z, I'm going to say that, in fact, there's a privacy violation here. Or I'm going to say, no, there isn't a privacy violation. Or it depends on what she exactly said, right? If she just said things at a certain level of generality about his sexual functions, that might not be as bad as if she says some things that are much, much more particularized. So it may depend on the sort of degree of particularity, sort of how the law will deal with this kind of case. But you see, this is a particular kind of lawmaking, right? Now, you can go to a state legislature if you're him and say, pass a law. But than exactly the questions that we were dealing with before, which is like, what kind of precedent is this going to set? What is this going to do in terms of the revealing of this sort of the information about the minister, the gay minister? What implications is it going to have for that? How do I have a dividing line, right? A principal dividing line between when I'm going to allow sort of recovery of some monetary damages for a breach of privacy and when not. Very often, when the First Amendment or free speech interests are balanced against the interests of privacy, the First Amendment or free speech wins. And you know, in this society, you could say that's a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your perspective. And we'll have lots of chances to visit the First Amendment in the future. Yeah.
Would the question of intent come up when if this woman were just vlogging, as people do, her own personal details, and it happened to get picked up by somebody who knew him, versus the case in Colorado where the lover came out with, you know, sort of to blow the whistle?
Well, I think, you know, intent can matter sometimes. Partly it depends on the nature of the claim. So that there actually is a special little common law claim that's known as intentional infliction of emotional distress. And so in the context of an intentional infliction of emotional distress, intent matters. I wouldn't be surprised if there wasn't the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim as part of the complaint that the lawyer drew up here, not just a privacy violation, but also another couple of claims. And so that is to say, in the context of privacy, it may not matter what your intent was, right? She might have said, I was just telling everybody, you know, how great you were, right? She could have intended to actually say, oh God, he's just great. And he could have said, I'm still humiliated, I still got fired, and so it doesn't make any difference whether you thought you were doing me a favor or not. So I think intent, we'll see intent from time to time. So let me share with you a second story, because you like that first one pretty well. This was in today's New York Times. So this actually is even, in the last one, you could say, oh, she's got a free speech right, he's got a privacy interest, those two in conflict. Okay, that's fairly simple. Here's a little bit more complicated one. Okay, so a particular guy named Gene wanted to rent out a spare bedroom in his West Hollywood apartment, and he had a few requirements. This is a quote. I am not looking for freaks, geeks, prostitutes, male or female, druggies, pet cobras, drama, black Muslims, or mortgage brokers. That's what he wrote on a website that's trying to match people who have rooms that they want roommates for, and people who want to be a roommate. Other users of this roommates.com website were adamant in their desire. It must be black, gay, male. Another one said, please, no flakes, deadbeats, or white trash. Another one said, that he was offering free rent for the right woman in exchange for quiet companionship in an intimate place. These are a set of postings. Now, there actually are fair housing laws that regulate discrimination in housing, right? There was a time, as probably you know from ancient history, when people wouldn't rent homes to black people, or wouldn't rent rooms or houses to, or they wouldn't sell to people of certain race or gender. In the 1960s, late 1960s, there was really an effort to try to eradicate discriminatory practices. And so we ended up with equal rights laws of various sort. And one of the equal rights laws is a fair housing law. And so it now bans sort of discrimination in the sale and other transactions for housing. And one of the things that's regulated, in addition to the fact that as somebody's selling a house or leasing a room or leasing an apartment, that you can't say, I don't want black people, or I don't want women, or I don't want this kind of person, I want that kind of person. You can't do that, not only one-on-one, right? When somebody who is of a ethnicity or skin color that you don't like comes and applies to buy your house, you can't say, I don't want to sell my house to you because I don't like your color. That's illegal in the United States. But in order to effectuate sort of the law, they're also, as part of that law, bans publishing discriminatory listings, right? Because, if when you try to sell the house or when you try to lease the apartment to somebody, that you say, in my ad, you know, no black people or only black people or whatever, right? Even if you don't have any clause in your sales agreement or in your lease saying, oh, I'm not going to rent or buy or sell to so-and-so or people of certain color, that if the ad that sort of let people know that it's available sort of signals this discriminatory intent, then that's right. So in order to protect against discriminatory practices, it's not just the sale and leasing itself, but also the publishing of advertisements about that that's made illegal. And I think you can see why, right, if you really want to accomplish your objective, it's not enough to say, well, you know, one-on-one, you can't discriminate. You also have to have something that creates a kind of an infrastructure that means that we'll have more fair housing rules. Okay, so there's a group of people who care about fair housing, and they sued roommates.com. And they could sue also the people who posted the notices, right? Because the people who posted the notices are announcing essentially an intent to discriminate on some basis that actually is not a basis, for the most part, that we will allow under these fair housing rules. So what do you think about that? Yeah. So that's a good question. Telephones and other kinds of communications media can be used to traffic in illegal stuff, right? So that you can use the telephone to say, I'm not going to rent to somebody who is a particular color. And you sort of say, the telephone company can't be liable for that, right? Why not? It's because they don't have any control over it whatsoever. You'd say, well, actually, the person who runs a website has more potential to have more control than the telephone company has when I pick up the phone and say, I'm not going to rent this to you because you're of a certain ethnicity. So there's more control that the person has. But we do want to say, gee, we should be really careful when you, especially if you have a very successful website. You can't know everything that's on your website all the time, you know, 24/7. It's like, you know, it's really hard. So maybe there are reasons why we want to actually create some immunity for people who provide a service to other people who provide information, right? And in fact, there is a special law called the Communications Decency Act. And the Communications Decency Act, which was mostly a really bad law, has a provision that the telephone and other internet service provider really love, which is an immunity from liability for content that they made available on their site but that they didn't author, right? So we'll talk about this more later in the semester, but there is a special privilege that the that Congress created for internet service providers precisely to protect them against this kind of widespread liability. And the telephone companies and the ISPs made a pretty big argument that that was a really important law, because that otherwise they would have to spend too much money and it would increase the cost of access to the internet and blah, blah, blah. And so Congress passed this immunity provision. Yeah. Yeah. So there's another little kink to this story. And the little kink is called the Mrs. Murphy exception. So there's an exception to the Fair Housing Rule for the sort of the mythical Mrs. Murphy, right? So the mythical Mrs. Murphy is somebody who, let's say, runs a boarding house. And she comes, you come to her place, and she just can't stand the look of you, right? She just doesn't want, she didn't trust you, she didn't think you were like, you know, just maybe it's prejudice or not, but she just hates your guts, and she's just not gonna rent to you for anything. So the Mrs. Murphy exception says that kind of, when you get down to it, you can actually decide not to sell your house to somebody, and you can decide not to rent your house to somebody. And even if there's some discriminatory sort of intent there, Mrs. Murphy kind of, for some things, gets accepted, right? So anybody who then does it. But you can't provide information about that, right? So you, as Mrs. Murphy, you can't post an ad saying only, you know, gay black males, right? And so the Mrs. Murphy exception doesn't apply to the sort of the to either the roommates.com or to the specific people who posted the notice, because if somebody showed up and they were a gay black male, and you sort of say, oh, exactly what I'm looking for, and so I'll rent to you right now, or if somebody, sort of a white female, comes and says, I'd like to rent the room, and so it's like, you're not a gay black male, it's what I'm looking for. You know, at that point, the Mrs. Murphy rule kicks in. But you see that what these people were doing actually was posting this information. And so this is another example, right, where you have legislation that the US Congress passed, their fair housing laws, and they're really meant to deal with a very difficult question and try to eradicate a kind of discrimination that made people feel really uncomfortable. It had this little out for Mrs. Murphy, but it limited the out for Mrs. Murphy because Mrs. Murphy can't say, I only want gay black males, right? She can't say that in an advertisement for it. Now, the roommates.com is saying, we're out of this because of the Communications Decency Act, right? It gives immunity. So it's one piece of federal legislation that says you can't do something, and there's another piece of federal legislation that says you get immunity. And the question is, which one trumps? Yeah.
I was wondering, would an ad that said no black people need apply be considered the same as one that said strong preference given to white people?
Yeah, they're treated the same. They're both signaling an intent to discriminate.
So is this catalog of criteria, is that a closed set of things?
I'm sorry?
Is this catalog of criteria that you cannot discriminate by, is that a very...
Well, I mean, it doesn't, you know, the thing is that I would say that you could probably put in there that you don't want prostitutes or drug addicts. I mean, it's not like drug addicts are like get First Amendment protection from housing discrimination and stuff like that. Yeah. Well, and as I said, you know, the way the world works, you can't stop kind of discrimination in the small. What you can try to do is stop discrimination in the large. But what I'm trying to sort of do with this particular second example here is to say, look, you got one statute over here that says this thing. You got another statute over here that says something else. If you follow this one, there's going to be liability for the roommates.com. If you do this one, then there won't be. How do you resolve a conflict like that? This is what judges have to deal with. But what would you kind of what way how would you try to think about that? Yeah.
First, look carefully at the immunity at the Communication Decency Act to see if the immunity applies specifically to content posts on the web, or is it just to traffickers like ISPs?
Right. So you want to actually look at it really closely. I think if you looked at the Communications Decency Act provision, what you'd see is that it does seem to have a pretty broad immunity. So information service providers is defined in a broad enough way, and the immunity is a pretty broad immunity. The California Supreme Court actually just recently, in a case called Barrett versus Rosenthal, decided that the immunity, in fact, is very broad. And that's about the 10th decision that gave a very broad scope to it. But it's not clear that decision would have any implications because it was a different kind of law. The Barrett and Rosenthal were fighting about. That was a different kind of it was like defamation claim, whereas this is a totally different kind of lawsuit. And so, you know, it's a statutory lawsuit, and that may make a difference. So, how would you try to think about it? Yeah, no, that's a good observation. Where I thought you were going to go with that is where I would have gone with the observation, which isn't to say that your observation wasn't perfectly keen. But one thing that you might think about is if you're a newspaper and you print the ad about only gay black males, you're definitely violation. Right, and I don't know that there's been a First Amendment challenge to it, but because we've had America has had such a bad history with discrimination, and there are regulations against hate crimes and various other things, one can imagine a court saying that even though this is a restriction on speech, it furthers this compelling interest, and there's no other way to stop discrimination in the housing market, yada yada, and therefore, on balance, the law is constitutional as applied to newspapers. But then you sort of say, well, okay, if it's constitutional as to newspapers, then is there some sort of First Amendment discrimination in the law if you do it online? Same ad, exactly same text. You put it online, now it's totally immune. Like, what kind of weird law is that, right? Now you can say, well, actually, it's because the Congress passed the statute, and so the statute basically, and so one way of sort of measuring it is, can you make those two things compatible? So one way of doing it is saying that when Congress passed the Communications Decency Act, it didn't contemplate that it was immunizing this thing which is about racial discrimination. And therefore, I'm going to create essentially an exception, right? I'm going to read a limitation into the Communications Decency Act that it doesn't actually contain, right? What judges do all the time is say, when the Congress passed this law, they didn't have this situation in mind, and therefore, the law is more limited than it looks like on its face. So this is an example of common law decision making by judges who are interpreting statutes, right? So just because a statute is a statute doesn't mean it's automatically totally clear how it's going to apply in a particular situation. You see what I'm saying? So what that means then is, like, one thing you could do is say, okay, they didn't have that in contemplation, so let me create a little exception. So the exception is for housing discrimination related things. And then later, right, somebody else could sort of do, you know, let's say a racially discriminating dating service, right? And so let's assume that there's another statute for dating services or something like that. And so the judge can say, oh, well, there was an exception created for this. This is the same kind of, this is also about trying to rectify racial discrimination, and therefore let me expand that exception to a racial discrimination exception rather than just an exception for racial discrimination in housing. Right? That's a way that judges can kind of deal with conflicting legal principles that kind of collide in any one fact situation. Another way judges can deal with it is to say, which one was passed later? Right? So typically, right, if you have one law that's passed over here and then another law that's passed 10 years later, or 20 years later in this case, then the later law tends to be interpreted as overriding any conflicting privilege that was in the law that was passed 20 years earlier. So we'll see some of the see how this kind of works itself out in some of the particular cases we're going to be studying. But I'm trying to just give you a sense now about sort of how law gets made, right? How judges actually deal with difficult situations, because the judge in this case wants to throw it out too, right? Judges don't like cases that are difficult. Sometimes they do, but a lot of times they don't. So they just want to get rid of them. And so, you know, this one presents some pretty tough issues. I think it's actually a tougher case and closer in terms of legal resolution than the cyber sex example that we talked about in a little bit. Okay, I meant to take a break. Do you want to take a break, or shall we just continue on and end 10 minutes early? I'm getting conflicting things. How many people want to go straight ahead? How many people want to take a break? And there's some I don't care. Okay, well, actually, if we take a majority rule, then I think we continue. But I promise next time I'll take a break. Okay, I will be more disciplined. But I was right in the middle of a story, and that's always a tough time. That's always a tough time to break. Okay, you up for that? Yeah. This particular class is being recorded because two of the members of the class informed me in advance that they had a conflicting obligation, which I decided was a worthy thing, and so I'm taping it. I'm not planning to tape every class.
Also this session.
Just this session, yeah, and it will be put up on the web. Okay. Well. So what else? So another thing that actually was in the newspaper Wednesday, January 17th, was about MySpace, and the article is entitled "MySpace Moves to Give Parents More Information." One of the reasons that MySpace is moved to give parents more information is because they're being sued. Now, there's nothing like a good lawsuit to get your attention. So why is MySpace being MySpace being sued? It's being sued because some of the young children, children below the ages of 16, have been engaged with by predators on young children, and the parents say that that MySpace is responsible for that, and so a group of 33 out of 50 states' attorneys general are investigating taking legal action against MySpace. Because saying that they should do two things. One is that they should raise the age limit of the site from 14, which is kind of like you have to be 14 now in order to sort of do make a profile and so forth on MySpace. And they want to raise that to 16 so that 14 and 15-year-olds can't use the site, and in addition, they want to force MySpace to do verification of MySpace members' ages, and so you have to like verify that in fact you're 16, because right, one of the things if you put on a form, say how old are you, and you're 13 and you want to get on MySpace, this is really cool. What are you going to do? You're going to lie, because I said. So you have to be 14. Okay, I'm 14. And so how are you, you know, how is MySpace, you know, who's got, what, gazillion members, right? People who are doing profiles and stuff. It can't keep track of all that. So what do you think? Should MySpace have a legal obligation, be forced to change the age? Should it be forced to verify the ages of children so that you again, we have this special solicitude in the law toward protecting children, right? We want to make sure that children are safe. And so that's a pretty important value, but That's not the only value. Yeah. So what does best effort look like?
Maybe they already have an effort in place to have an age limit, and changing that number is not difficult for them. But that system they have in place obviously doesn't work. I mean, if an 8-year-old is capable of lying about their age, and it doesn't actually keep anyone out.
Okay, but you know, in connection with, see, part of what's nice is we can sort of say, oh, they should use their best efforts. But you know, you gotta, if you're running an organization like MySpace, you gotta operationalize that, right? What does that mean in terms of actual details of how you ought to do things, right? Now, if you talk about sort of older people, age verification is actually not so difficult, right? Because you can use other kinds of databases of driver's license information or credit records or credit card information. Presumably, if you have a credit card, they know how old you are and stuff like that. So when we're talking about age verification, it's not impossible to do when you're talking about people who are 18 and older. But age verification becomes pretty complicated when you're talking about people who are 13, 14, 15, 16 years old. Maybe 16-year-olds will have driver's licenses, although not all of them will. So what would you do if you were MySpace? Mm-hmm.
Maybe instead of verifying the child's age.
I'm sorry?
Maybe instead of verifying the child's age directly, you could make it like parental permission kind of thing where the parent has to get some of their information or the child.
Right. So presumably the parent knows how old the child is. And so one thing, that one option, right, in this space is to actually then before someone is able to make a profile and essentially operate within the social network of MySpace, that they ought to get verification from the parents, right? MySpace ought to have to communicate with the parents and get the parents' permission. Yeah?
It sounds like it's a good idea, but another way is if it's easy to verify the identities of people over 18, you know, you can link every MySpace profile to a real physical identity that will probably come back on, you know, perverse activities by the older people.
Okay. Yes. Right. So, in fact, a couple of the other social networking sites have announced that they will not do the age verification because all of the procedures that they have thought of for age verification actually violate the privacy of their users. And they have privacy policies that they have announced. And one of the things that the Federal Trade Commission has been trying to do over the last decade or two is to induce firms to have privacy policies. And if you make a privacy policy, you announce it, you put it up on your website, and then you violate it, the Federal Trade Commission will come after you with a hammer and tongs and will say, in fact, you're engaged in an unfair and deceptive practice. And so let me just stop here for a second and say, so another way that law gets made is by having general laws like the Federal Trade Commission Act. Section 5 of that act says that the Federal Trade Commission has authority to challenge in court unfair and deceptive trade practices. And that's a pretty general concept, right? It can apply in all kinds of situations. Well, in the last decade, the FTC has brought a number of actions against companies that violated privacy policies, right? Said, I'm going to protect this data, and then they released the data. That's been seen as an unfair and deceptive trade practice, and people have had to pay fines, and they've had to like change their practices and yada yada. So one sort of response might be, well, we got these privacy policies, we don't want to do that. But also, right, part of what people want to do when they're on these social networking sites is in some sense play with a new identity, right? With an identity and a different name and a different, you know, and if I'm short and overweight, I want to be tall and skinny. If I'm tall and skinny, I want to be sort of shorter plumper. And so people are trying out kind of new identities, and that's sort of what part of what the social value is, right? At least for a lot of kids. So insofar as you say, you can't file a profile until I know exactly what your identity is and I know exactly how old you are and I've gotten your parents' permission for you to develop a site here, you see that that's actually something that is pretty tough. I'm sorry?
Whether or not somebody is a minor, is that something protected by privacy?
I would say in some situations, yes. In some situations, no. Is it totally clear in this particular circumstance whether minors have any kind of anonymity interest? The answer is no, it's not clear. There are cases about anonymity, and anonymity is sometimes protected. Children tend to be more closely regulated by the state, and so they may have lesser anonymity interests than adults do, but it isn't necessarily the case that children don't have any kind of anonymity interest. And one can imagine some situations, in fact, which we want to make sure that the children, in fact, can remain anonymous. So police are concerned about some kids drinking after school, and they go around and they take all kinds of pictures of the children and they put it up on the internet and say, if you see this person drinking, report to us. You can imagine a set of parents saying, that's a violation of the privacy interests and our interest in our child actually not having their picture put up on the internet in order for you to try to catch a few people who are drinking, right? So that's a situation in which the kind of the anonymity interests might be a little bit different than they would be in this kind of MySpace type of example. But another factor that we didn't talk about yet. Yeah, sure.
I was just wondering if any cases involving 1-800 numbers and the telephone and you know, what was the same type of technology, and involve these same issues. So how courts dealt with that when a kid, when parents sued, say, because their child was able to access that, even though they said they were 21.
Yeah, I don't know of any involving 800 numbers. There are some cases involving 900 numbers because 900 numbers actually are ones that you have to pay for. And so to the extent that you entice kids into listening to some of these 900 things, it's not only potentially exposing them to some indecent material that as a society we might not want them to have access to, but also it's incurring huge charges that parents will probably be responsible for. And it's the latter interest that has essentially limited, has been a factor in limiting the ability to sort of to peddle this stuff to the kids. So, you know, how do you deal with that? You essentially focus on a place where you can get age verification, right? So that you have to have a credit card or some other identification as an adult to be able to use the 900 numbers. I don't know of any involving 800 numbers, but you see what we're doing is we're sort of developing a kind of a rich complex of sort of how law tries to make certain kinds of distinctions. And yeah, that's true, but there are lots of situations where we do not protect anonymity totally. Here is a situation where because there were some abuses, right? A lot of what happens, a lot of the way that American law gets made is somebody does something that isn't illegal already, and people then get outraged about it and say, oh, gotta be a law. And then a law will get passed, or the Federal Trade Commission or some state consumer protection organization or some other state agency will say, oh, terrible, and either threaten a lawsuit or actually bring a lawsuit, challenge the activity, and then people will often settle those lawsuits because it's some bad publicity for them if you've done something wrong. So one of the things that companies like MySpace can do is wait for the lawsuit to hit, right? Or change their practices, right? And so maybe they can do some things. Now, one of the things that they're trying to do, the move that this Wall Street Journal article talks about, is to provide software that parents can use to install on their home computer, and that will then monitor what the child is doing on MySpace, right? And so they can control access to, right? And so if you're a 13-year-old and you're in the house, then you're blocked from accessing it. But if you're the 15-year-old in the house, you can access it, but essentially the software will keep track a little bit of information. So you can't read the kids' emails, but you can sort of see their profile and stuff like that, right? So this is a kind of a business response. And part of the reason that you want to have a business response and not just kind of wait till the litigation process works itself out is you don't want litigation, right? Litigation, right? This is bad publicity for MySpace. Why is this bad publicity for MySpace? Why would you not want to be MySpace and have something like
that?
Blah, yeah, so pedophiles has got the bad people. And so the kind of the current architecture of the system is promoting pedophiles. And MySpace is run by Rupert Murdoch, and it's like they're owned by News Corp, and he kind of doesn't like stuff like that. So he tries to be associated with like a more positive thing. So one of the things that you try then to do is try to avert the lawsuit, avert bad publicity by announcing kind of a positive technical response here, right? So the technical response to try to do it. And from the standpoint of MySpace, this is better than getting permission from parents. Why? Why would you not want to, if you're MySpace, why do you not want to get, why do you not have to want to have to get permission? Yeah.
I think it's going to keep customers away.
I'm sorry?
It's going to keep people away.
So you got this problem, right? Which is you want to have millions and millions and millions of people. And MySpace, if it requires your parents have to write a note, and they have to verify. Not only is it expensive to do that, right? It's expensive if you have to verify by each parent. But also, the kids will say, I don't want to go to a social network site where my parents are going to, you know, say whether I can do it or not. I'll go to another site, right? Because there are a lot of social networking sites. And so MySpace, they want to monetize the base, right? They've got a nice big base of lots of people, and they want to monetize that. And how are they going to monetize that? Advertising, right? So another reason why MySpace wants to be able to offer this market solution and a technical solution is because they don't want to have to do the age verification by parents, which will then cause sort of a flight of its base, which then means that there's smaller numbers of people, which means that your ad revenues are going to be lower. And so they've got this kind of conflicting thing. Now, one of the things that happens sometimes is that courts basically, or that companies will say, you know, if I'm going to do it, other people ought to have to do it too. So MySpace doesn't want to be in a situation where it's being sued by these attorneys general and it's going to have to change its age thing and nobody else is, right? And so it could then say, okay, well, if I'm going to have to raise my age till 16 and I'm going to have to verify, then everybody else has to too. And that's when you get these calls to go to Congress or calls to go to state legislature to get a law that requires everybody to have to do the same thing so that MySpace doesn't suffer from kind of loss of clientele because of the loss of clientele because of this one requirement as to them that other people don't have to suffer under. The other thing about sort of the ads, besides the size of the population that you want to be able to monetize, is that you want to say, I've done this thing to respond to the pedophilia problem because advertisers don't want to advertise on MySpace if it's seen as a place where pedophiles are doing their business. Okay, so they've got some market-based incentives to try to respond in some way, not necessarily the way that the state's attorneys general want them to respond, but they want to respond in some way, right, to get the lawsuit off their back, but also to mean that they're not going to sort of lose the user base now that is really important to them. Okay, well, I could go on and on and on, because I have this many more. Things, but let's spend a few minutes kind of going over the curriculum. So, syllabus. Okay, if you don't already have a reader, you're going to need a reader for at least the other classes that I teach. Very often, all the materials are up on the web. This is not true as to these materials, and so a reader is really essential. I think you got an email about how to get a reader. I'm going to ask you a lot of really close questions about things that are in the reader from now on. And so having a reader and reading the reader is really important, okay? So that's to know. Okay, so today we're sort of doing a kind of overview, and part of what I've been trying to do is acquaint you with a little bit about sort of different areas of information policy that we're going to be covering over the course of the semester, talking a little bit about the mechanisms, right? The lawsuit that's done on a kind of common law basis, the lawsuit that's done based on a statute, and statutes still have to be interpreted. I've talked a little bit about what do you do if there's one law over here that seems to point in one direction, another law over here that points in another direction. So a little bit of hint about how how courts try to deal with that. And law gets made not only through those kind of mechanisms, but also through rulemaking. Very often you have something like the Federal Trade Commission that Congress will pass a law saying, do something about protecting children online from having their privacy violated. And so the FTC then will hold hearings, and people will come in and make proposals about what they should do or not do, and then the Federal Trade Commission will essentially promulgate a draft rule, receive comments on it, and then that rule will then be finalized, and then that rule essentially becomes the law as to that sort of thing. So there are a number of other mechanisms, but at least I've given you a sort of an initial take about sort of some of those lawmaking processes and the kinds of issues that judges try to deal with. So the next thing that we're going to do is go and talk about copyright. And we're going to visit copyright in at least two contexts. The first is thinking about compilations of data. All of you in your everyday lives deal with data compilations all the time. And when you are out being professionals in your field, you're going to also be dealing with data compilations all the time. Some data compilations are protected by copyright law, some of them aren't. And part of what I'm going to try to do is help you kind of understand sort of what are the criteria and what are the circumstances in which data compilations are protected, and what about those data compilations are protected by copyright law, and what things aren't. And so again, baseline set of things that's worth your knowing about. We'll come back and talk about copyright a second time a little bit later in the course of the semester by taking a look at what are the default rules of copyright. If you are working for a firm or you're a consultant and you create something, you know, or you write a report or you write some software or you make a drawing or whatever, sort of what are the default rules about when you're in this situation? Do you own the copyright, if any, in what you created, or does your employer, or does the person who paid for it? Sort of knowing a little bit about kind of the default rules is probably going to be helpful, because you're going to be out there creating original works of authorship a lot in your professional careers, and just knowing what the default rules look like and then how do they change, right? If somebody works with you on a project, are they a joint author? And in what circumstances are they a joint author with you of that thing? Those are another set of questions that I think it's worth your having some understanding about. Jumping back to data compilations for a moment, one of the other sort of very common things today, although 20 years ago it wasn't so common, is that information is licensed, right? And so there's not just one layer of protection for data. Sometimes in addition to a copyright in the data compilation, there will be a license that attaches to that data. And certain things that if you did it without the license might be not a violation of copyright law at all. In fact, they're free to do it if there's no license. Well, what happens if there's a license attached to it? And does the license change? And does the license change? Should we think differently about licensed information than we think about just in terms of pure copyright? And what are the tensions between licensing law and copyright law, and how do we resolve it, right? If copyright law says it's important for this kind of stuff to be free, can a license override it? And second set of questions about licensing have to do with whether or not, you know, it's one thing if you and I sit down and we hammer out an agreement. I've got this data that you really want, and I say, okay, here's the terms under which I'm willing to make that that information available to you. I think we can, off the top of our head, say that situation is different than I buy a CD-ROM in the marketplace and it comes with a little shrink wrap license that says you can't do X, Y, or Z with it, right? That doesn't look as much like a I negotiated and I have a meeting of minds with you about sort of what you can and can't do, right? So where I think socially more in tune with the idea that if you individually negotiate a license, and you've reached a meeting of the minds about kind of what you can do with the stuff and what you can't do with the stuff, that's okay, right? Then we respect that license, and even if the activity is something that, in the absence of the license, you'd be free to do, the license actually rules, okay? But there have been a lot of sort of public policy questions raised in the last decade or so about how much deference to give to shrink wrap, click through, and what are sometimes now called browse wrap licenses. And so how much can individual firms with data compilations essentially restrict access and use that otherwise would be free, and what are the public policy limitations on that kind of use? So that's one set of questions that we'll be talking about. Another set of topics that we'll be talking about is, you know, if you are the supplier of some very valuable data and somebody develops a new technology that enables a kind of a cool new use of that information, who gets to control that information flow, right? Can you, as a provider of that really important, cool information, can you stop somebody else from making a technology that makes it more useful? Or should the people who make technology that enable some new use be free to do that, right? So where is that control mechanism? Who gets to control the flow of that particular information? And what are the limitations on that? So we'll be reading the NBA versus Motorola case in connection with that. Licensing raises a whole bunch of issues, and we're only going to have a chance to take a look at a few of them. First thing we're going to look at is the enforceability of licenses that restrict certain uses of data. We're also going to think about consumer protection, right? One of the things that that we want to do is make sure that consumers aren't disadvantaged, and there are a couple of situations in which people have made arguments that even if the license overall is enforceable, that certain clauses of the contract or certain causes of the license shouldn't be enforced because public policy favors a particular kind of use, or public policy favors protecting consumers against certain kinds of things that people might want to put in their licenses. A big part of a kind of consumer protection issues in this space over recent years has been about changing terms, right? So that's a pretty important thing. Okay, so we'll deal then with some consumer protection issues. If you sell out defective information, are you responsible for that? It's another set of questions that you should worry about, and I'll try to provide some guidance about. We're going to talk about information privacy in a number of contexts. We're going to talk a little bit about regulating indecent content, net neutrality, and internet jurisdiction. So as you can see, we're going to cover really a pretty broad array of things. I think it's, again, going to be a lot of fun to do this. And I'm looking forward to it very much. So you all should have had two pieces of paper. One is the syllabus and the other is a document. What happened to the rest of the writing assignments? Is anybody? Okay. Somebody forgot to send the writing assignments around. Good thing I asked. Although it's on the website in case you lose the paper. So as I mentioned earlier, this course is going to give you a chance to work on your writing skills. The good news is that writing is a learnable skill. And so just because you don't feel like you're a very good writer today doesn't mean that you're not going to become a really good writer by the end of this class. As I said earlier, writing is an absolutely key skill for a professional. So you will be well off by working on your writing. And the first assignment is to give me some advice. And I provide you with a lot of information about it. I'm making the first assignment due by noon next Monday, because on Tuesday morning I'm going to be going to Washington, D.C., and I'm going to be talking to members of Congress and to congressional staffers about the issue that's talked about there. And I want you to tell me what I should say. Okay? Now, this is, as I said, this is an advanced civics class in a way, because, right, I get a chance to say some things to people in Congress about what they ought to do or not do about mashups and remixes. Okay? Should they say, burn them all in hell? Should they throw them in jail? Should we say, bravo? Should we create a special exception for them? I want you to sort of offer your thoughts about that, and it's fine to sort of do, you know, to rely on your own experience, right? If you've made some mashups and remixes yourself, and you want to talk about sort of how you think that was why that was a good thing or not, then talk to me about it. Alex will be available to give you some guidance about this if you want. But just try to write well. That's the most important thing. Okay? So see you next Monday. Okay. I do need to give you permission. I don't usually take undergraduates in this class. What year are you in your schooling?
I'm a senior in my last semester.
Okay.
Majored in electrical engineering and computer science, mostly computer science.